It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.
The last 8 years have represented a sea change in the Wisconsin political environment. The election of Scott Walker as governor in 2010 ushered in an era of Republican dominance at many levels, including the 2016 presidential election. Donald Trump won Wisconsin, a result that surprised many national political observers.
The story of Wisconsin's transformation is a familiar one to people who live in the state, but writer Dan Kaufman believes it's one that holds relevance to people in the rest of the country. Kaufman is a Madison native who now lives in Brooklyn and has written for The New Yorker and The New York Times Magazine. His new book is called The Fall of Wisconsin, and Dan Kaufman joins us in the studio to talk about it. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Mitch.
So as you set about telling the story of Wisconsin's political transformation to a national audience, what was the biggest misconception you encountered about what people thought they knew about this state's story?
It's hard to say if there was any one single thing. I think what it told us is how this effort by conservatives to transform Wisconsin's politics, but also in doing so to transform the country's politics, was happening kind of through a thousand cuts. There was obviously the big battle of Act 10, which is probably the most significant and most defining. But there were many other things that were being done at this time to kind of, in my view, turn the state over to outside interests, not the citizens. It had a progressive past, a very strong and important one. It had also voted for Joe McCarthy twice. As people know, George Wallace, the Alabama segregationist governor, got his first real political start in Milwaukee.
Right. So was there always this kind of undercurrent of discord?
There was different strands, like most American states and cities. That said, it offered the country a kind of model that was unusual. I will give you a few examples. The whole kind of idea of social insurance sort of pretty much came out of the University of Wisconsin at the turn of the century. It became, some people say that most of the New Deal was actually drafted originally in Wisconsin and then was nationalized. The author of the Social Security Act was a man named Edwin Witte, and he, well, as well as a few other Wisconsinites and some other people, but he was the main driver of it, and he was a professor at the University of Wisconsin. Unemployment insurance, workers' compensation, these kind of pragmatic, progressive reforms that made life better for the majority of the state's citizens, and then by extension, the country's citizens. The idea that a company had to have some responsibility for a worker being killed on the job. These were things that were real problems 110 years ago. And these reforms lasted and persisted. The idea of collective bargaining wasn't invented in Wisconsin, but it was the first state to grant collective bargaining rights to municipal workers in 1959 and then extended to state workers. This was by a Republican governor.
I was just going
to
say, I gather that this was really not a partisan issue. A lot of these weren't. I mean, like the progressive name that we associate with progressivism, the La Follettes, were at one point Republicans.
They were Republicans, very much so. The state was thoroughly Republican. The Republican Party was founded here in a one-room schoolhouse in Ripon, Wisconsin. Now, there was a split, and eventually Bob La Follette, whom you mentioned, formed his own party, a progressive party. But the idea that you mentioned is really true, and you can even see it. Even Governor Walker claimed that Act 10 was a progressive reform. He used that word because it does have a salience in Wisconsin beyond party identity. Now, that has eroded. That's true. But I would say that if I was really struck that he still continued to use that word to describe something that none of the progressives of the previous century would argue was progressive at all. So
a lot of this all kind of reaches kind of the national radar in 2010. You describe the situation today as Wisconsin being kind of like a living laboratory for conservative reforms. What did conservatives on a national scale see in Wisconsin in, 2008, 2009, 2010 that made the time right for this transformation to start?
Well, you had the financial crisis, and accompanying that was the rise of the Tea Party. And they wanted to impose, libertarian Republicans, conservative Republicans have long railed against the federal government. They don't see a role for it in social programs, or at least a very marginal role. You can see that in people like Paul Ryan, whose intellectual hero is Ayn Rand, who basically thought that this created a culture of dependency and that people should be completely consumed with their individualistic goals. That was very antithetical to the Wisconsin of the past. I think what you had in 2010 was a Tea Party wave. And Scott Walker, like many other aspiring Republicans, was almost auditioning for a role with some powerful donors, Charles and David Koch, the Bradley Foundation, who is in Milwaukee and had been a supporter of his efforts as Milwaukee County Executive, as many, I'm sure all of your listeners know. I think what you had is him creating a blueprint, particularly for attacking labor. He went further than most. And it was replicated by many places, even recently in 2017. It continues to be replicated. For example, in Iowa, they passed a very extreme version of Act 10 that even included police and fire departments. This has transformed the electorate to some degree. It has atomized the state's population. You know, the labor movement has had problems over the years. There's been racism. There's been corruption. But it also has served an important role as a counterweight to this infrastructure of business interests and so on. And it was clearly, Act 10 was clearly a political attack, as well as everything else that Walker purported it to be.
Do you think, was there a general frustration among some with the strength of labor unions, or did Act 10 and the climate around it sort of create this general frustration?
My view is that it stoked resentment in a time of economic insecurity. Some of those feelings may have been there, but also this economic insecurity, particularly in rural areas, was decades long. You have to look at the state. For example, there were 150,000 dairy farmers in Wisconsin after the Second World War. There are now fewer than 9,000. A lot of these rural communities have been depleted. At the same time, we're producing the same amount of milk as we used to. So people, these communities are hurting. Sometimes the only people that might have health insurance in a small town, people that work for the school, the city workers or public workers. And so there was a lot of anger that, and Walker deliberately stoked this anger. And it was telegraphed in his inaugural address. He said, the taxpayers can no longer be the have-nots and the public workers, the haves. So he was clearly engendering this rather than saying, oh, maybe we should try to work on getting health insurance for everyone.
Right. There was nothing in that speech to say, well, maybe everyone should be the haves.
Exactly. Which would have been more, I would argue, in the spirit of the state's progressive tradition of Bob La Follette, which was essentially trying to help lifting everyone up rather than pitting people against each other. And Walker, famously, as most of your listeners probably know, telegraphed his strategy to his billionaire donor, Diane Hendricks, probably his most important backer, in a private conversation captured by a filmmaker named Brad Lichtenstein, who said, you know, she asked, when will Wisconsin become a completely red state? When will we become right to work? She conflated the two, and they are related. You know, as labor gets eroded, its strength, the Democratic Party gets weakened and a state tends to become more Republican. A recent study showed that right-to-work states correlate to a 3.5% drop in Democratic turnout and voting. So and he said to her, you know, we are going to use divide and conquer. You know, first we're going to attack the collective bargaining rights of public workers. And then, of course, 4 years later, he signed a right-to-work law.
Well, and so then when we flash forward to 2016, what did Hillary Clinton miss here? Why did the Clinton campaign not make more effort in this state? Was it just, you know, looking at historical voting patterns?
I think they definitely missed something. I think there was an overconfidence, a hubris, if you will, about Wisconsin. And even though it had voted blue, you know, for example, in 2004, John Kerry narrowly won it. There's a lot of things I go into in the book about that. I think there was a combination of factors. I think the state's Democrats tend to be probably to the left of the National Democrats. You saw that in the Act 10 protest. This was the only – this was really the first mass grassroots political action from the left in a long time. And it was very – there were huge numbers of people that sparked a kind of rethinking. At the same time, National Democrats did not really support these efforts. President Barack Obama did not come to Wisconsin to defend collective bargaining rights, and he wouldn't even make a brief stop for Tom Barrett when he was running the recall campaign. Now, Hillary Clinton, I think her record with labor was very difficult for her to sell. She was a former corporate board member of Walmart, as well as a longtime supporter of free trade agreements that have really hollowed out a lot of Milwaukee and southeastern Wisconsin's industrial base. And these issues have a huge salience across the industrial Midwest, and I think that resonated. People forget, too, that Donald Trump, in his speeches, which were marked by racial resentment and nativism, also defended the welfare state. He said, "We will not..." You know, Ted Cruz is going to cut Social Security. I'm going to defend it. Medicare. He also railed against NAFTA and these other agreements. So I think he was successful in Clinton's absence of peeling off a portion of the white working class.
So Wisconsin is where you grew up. In doing the reporting for this book, do you think there were fundamental things that you maybe didn't realize about your fellow Wisconsinites when you were growing up here?
Yes. I mean, I'm a journalist. I'm always interested in learning, and I learned a lot. I was reporting for 7 years, really, although the book really began in earnest after Trump's victory. But I'd written a lot of articles about the state's political battles in the New York Times and the New Yorker. And I learned so much about Milwaukee, labor history, the state, you know, the Bayview Massacre, things like this, as well as the environmental traditions, particularly among the indigenous communities. I spent a lot of time up in the Bad River Reservation. It was a very enlightening experience for me to see their perspective, which I mean, I knew about, but I had never, you know, spent extensive time with them. So, yes, I did learn a lot. I learned also about the state's, you know, ability to be mercurial, as we mentioned. You know, it can vote the other way. At the same time, I do think there were certain fundamentals that have been changed. Maybe I never want to say permanently, but there was the idea that citizens should be encouraged to vote. That was a bipartisan note. The state used to have one of the most liberal voter registration policies. It was encouraged. Citizens should be participants. This was a legacy of Bob La Follette, who really encouraged active citizenship. And that was – both sides accepted that. Environmentalism, that was really a bipartisan tradition. Tommy Thompson preserved a lot of natural lands. And there were other things that seemed out of character. And I think that that is because there were these outside interests. It wasn't really driven by the state's citizens, certainly not the majority of them. But there was a receptive audience because things had been eroded for a time. That's my view. And there were some wealthy Wisconsinites, but there was also these out-of-state groups like, and I detail this in my book, the American Legislative Exchange Council, a very important group in transforming states. They propagate model bills that privatize education, strip away environmental regulations. They do things piecemeal, so you might not notice it. But after 40 years, if you look back, you can see, wow, we've really come a long way towards giving corporations the right to determine our environmental policy. In Wisconsin, that was extreme with this mining battle that happened in the Bad River when a mining company basically wrote part of a law that would give them what they wanted. And that idea that the citizen, the representative, isn't actually drafting it seemed antithetical.
If this blueprint kind of made itself visible, you know, this conservative blueprint made itself apparent as you looked into this, at the same time, were you left with any kind of a blueprint that progressives might look at for having the pendulum swing back the other way?
That's an interesting question. I mean, Wisconsin had been that laboratory of democracy. This is Justice Louis Brandeis's famous phrase, and he was really thinking of Wisconsin. For a long time, you know, when they passed the workers' compensation law here, it was modeled in many other states because it had been successfully. And there were a lot of times court challenges to these progressive reforms. And Wisconsin, very skillfully using the expertise of the university, the kind of the heart of the Wisconsin idea, crafted very, very well-wrought legislation that withstood a lot of these court challenges. And then they became the template. So, I mean, I don't see that right now, but I do think that if progressives and, again, I'm a journalist, but if progressives wanted to look at Wisconsin's past, also the pragmatic reformist tradition of Milwaukee socialism, which was basically trying to invest in the public sphere, libraries, schools, the lakefront, beautiful, beautiful lakefront here, that is a legacy of these socialist mayors. And I think these kinds of things could be modeled. And then you see them, in a sense, some of the movement of people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Randy Bryce or Senator Bernie Sanders. There has been a revival for public investment, for the public sphere. Whether it can be successful politically, I don't know, partly because, you know, the labor movement is very much weakened. And that was kind of a very powerful force in American life. Beyond just labor, for example, the civil rights movement, it really was dependent on the help of labor.
Well, Dan Kaufman, remarkable job in showing Wisconsin to itself here.
Well, it's just, it's been great talking to you, Mitch, and I'm glad to bring the book here. I'm anxious for people to read it in the place where these stories were forged. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Dan Kaufman grew up in Wisconsin. He now lives in New York. His new book is called The Fall of Wisconsin, The Conservative Conquest of a Progressive Bastion, and the Future of American Politics. He was in town last week for a discussion at Boswell Book Company.
You can hear more interviews like this one by visiting the Lake Effect page at WUWM.com.